which is a continuation of man as he is in this world. His day is a moment in perpetual time, that is, human time is but a fraction of the duration of universal time. What is a day for him is hardly a moment in the unrolling of time. He is the prey of the minutes and the hours. He is actually swallowed up by time. Every minute his life is devoured. Every hour he loses a precious stretch of his lifespan. And this is a favorite imagery of negative philosophers, that the moment one is born, he starts dying. Each moment that he lives takes him nearer his grave. Well, that is one side of things. It is not the full truth. But in this mood, in which all the difficulties with which man is surrounded are recounted, he is described as the prey of the minutes and the hours. Assailed on earth and unassured of heaven, he is attacked on all sides while living on earth. But on that account, nobody assures him of the crown in heaven. It is only a promise of religions. Rationally, man cannot be convinced that something that eludes him here is kept safe for him elsewhere. Assailed on earth and unassured of heaven, descended here unhappy and sublime, man, the soul of man that has descended here on earth, unhappy in all the surroundings and yet sublime, something of the original sublimity is retained by the self, the inner being of man. Despite all the unhappy circumstances and environment here, a link between the demigod and the beast below, and the half-god above, man is the link. In the transition of evolution from the animal state to something more than man, and yet something less than God, man is the link. Man is the bridge. He knows not his own greatness, nor his aim. Man Very few of us know our real aim. There are so many aims surrounding us, crowding around us, that the real aim is not always present before our eyes. And moreover, man knows not his own greatness. He is always prone to be more conscious of his imperfections of his miseries, then is legitimate. He forgets that there is something great, something sublime in his own being. He has forgotten why he has come and whence. His spirit and his members are at war. His spirit means his soul, his divine element, and his nether members of nature are at conflict. His heights break off too low to reach the skies. Indeed, he soars high, but the highest height that he can reach is still lower, still below, to be able to reach the skies. That is, he falls short, his highest attempts fall short of the heights of the heavens. His mass is buried in the animal mire. His physical body, his physical origin, is steeped in animal mire, that is, in the earth, full of animality. A strange antinomy is his nature's rule. His nature is a field of strange dualities. A riddle of opposites is made his field of action, his field of experience is a place of contradictions. Everywhere there is contradiction, everywhere there is conflict, and freedom he asks, but needs to live in bonds. That is, man asks for freedom, prays for freedom, but he feels very uncomfortable if he is asked to shed his bonds. And what are the bonds? The bonds that tie him down are desire, ego, division. Now, in these self-imposed limits, he feels safe, he feels secure, and he needs to live, to feel comfortable, he needs to live in the self-imposed bonds. And yet, something in him cries out for freedom. Freedom, he asks, but needs to live in bonds. He has need of darkness to perceive some light. These are all the riddles of opposites. In order to be able to perceive some light, he needs a background of darkness. Otherwise his eyes are dazzled. And need of grief to feel a little bliss. If there is a perpetual bliss, if man is given continuous happiness, he gets bored. He takes it for granted, and he would want some excitement, some agitation to feel some type of thrill. So he can appreciate a little bit of bliss if he has suffered grief, if he has suffered sorrow, if he has undergone some grief, then he can really take the delight of even a little bliss, a little experience of bliss. He has need of death to find a greater life. A greater life, Sri Aurobindo often writes how death is a passage to a greater life. A greater life means a life that is not limited, that is not bounded by physical limits, by physical dimensions. there is a larger, subtler dimension. And once you shed the physical sheath, you emerge in an infinitely larger world. So it is a larger life, and man can't enter into it unless he dies physically. There is a hint here. He has need of death. Death is there because it plays a role. Death is there because it provides a passage. Without death, as man is at present, he cannot transit into that zone of larger life. He has not arrived at that maturity of consciousness which some yogis do have to simply consciously walk into a larger dimension without being overtaken by death. They may shed the body, that is another matter, but they are not overcome by death. So death is not and need not be a permanent feature of our life. If we can have that control over ourselves to shed the physical sheath at will and wake into a higher state of existence, that is what is called Ichchamrityu, then death is no longer indispensable. He has need of death to find a greater life. All sides he sees and turns to every call. He is so distraught. He doesn't have a single aim. He doesn't have a single direction. He looks on all sides, and wherever there is a call, he turns towards it. It may be a right call, it may be a pseudo call, it may be a wrong call, but every call he must listen and take note of. All sides he sees and turns to every call. He has no certain light by which to walk. The light which leads him, the mental light which he uses for his journey, is certainly not always reliable. It is not always correct. There are many lights, many pseudo-lights, which mislead him, turn him away from the right path. That is why he says he has no certain light by which to walk. That is, it is only by turning within and drawing out the light of the soul that one can have an unfailing light to walk by. His life is a blind man's buff, a hide and seek. You know, it is a game of hide and seek where men put bandages over their eyes, pretend to be blind, and try to find out people. It is a game. So man's life as it is a game of hide and seek. Things elude him. He searches and lays his hands on wrong things. The right things escape his grasp. He seeks himself, and from himself he runs. In his awakened moments, he wants to know who is he. He wants to reach his own reality. But what does he do in practice? He does everything which leads him away from his soul, which pulls him away from himself. He runs with every desire, he runs with every attractive vision, and every moment that distracts him, takes him away from his central pursuit. He seeks himself, and from himself he runs. Meeting himself, he thinks it other than he. This is important, because if by chance, apparently, that is a stroke of grace, if he were to meet his own being, his own soul, he finds it difficult to recognize it as himself, because he is operating from the ego level. He is operating from a level of surface personality with which he has identified himself. And when he is face to face with his true being, the inner self, he thinks it's something else. So there is a difference between I and you. Always he builds, but finds no constant ground. He goes on erecting edifices. He goes on building constructions. But the ground gives way. There is no stable ground on which what he builds can last. Always he journeys, but nowhere arrives. He goes on walking and walking, journeying. Ultimately he arrives nowhere. Now this applies to every one of us. We go on doing what we are doing every day without thinking, why? Why am I doing it? Where is it leading me? I get up and go through my routine every day because I have been doing it all these years. We work like any labor. My mother would say, work is labor for many. We are not conscious what we are doing, why we are doing, to what extent we are benefiting, to what extent what we are doing is the right thing. We hardly have time to detach ourselves and observe whether what we are doing is right, what we are doing is expected of us, what we are doing is what we should be doing. Instead of that, we journey, we walk, we work. Work, work, work. We have no time to meet people, we have no time to be polite to people, we have no time to be considerate to people. We are rushing. For what? It was always a predicament to mother to watch people rushing. She said, rushing, rushing. But why? Where are they rushing? Where is their base? But everybody has a sense of doing something, doing something. And she says that there is the fear of being idle, the fear of not doing anything is an illusion. It is another trap to keep us running. We have the feeling that we are doing something. But where are we running? And why? Now this, he puts it in one sentence. Always he journeys, but nowhere arrives. It is the same thing, whether it is physical work or mental work like reading, writing, or even meditations. Go on meditating 1 hour, 2 hours. I've seen people work meditating for 3 hours and 4 hours. They have the satisfaction of meditating, but how? What does it do? Is it related? Is it related to the daily life? Do my meditations of today, whether it is 1 hour or 4 hours, improve the quality of my life tomorrow? Have I got the time to assess the spillout of this meditative exercise? We don't have the time. And this journey, going somewhere, ultimately the traveler finds that he arrives nowhere. Next, he would guide the world. Himself he cannot guide. This is another thing. Everybody wants to advise. Everybody wants to run other people's lives. Everybody wants to give the benefit of his wisdom, experience. But themselves, they cannot guide themselves. If they were really guiding themselves, they would not advise another person. None of us, let us be frank, is in a position to really know what is good for another. What is good for another externally may not be that good for his inner growth. The outer difficulties may have been specially designed for his inner growth. And if we start advising to circumvent the difficulties in our worldly manner, we are doing harm to the person. So, to guide the world, one must have arrived at a state of consciousness when one can identify oneself with the being of the other person, know the need and respond to it. Till then, we have no right to help others or guide others or advise others. He would guide the world, himself he cannot guide. He would save his soul, his life he cannot save. That is, in their zeal to have moksha, liberation, they ignore the body, they care less for their life. They treat it as a pariah and go on with their austerities, with their tapasya to save the soul. But his life at his door, they cannot save, they cannot look after it. The light his soul has brought, his mind has lost. The soul which has come from the divine, naturally, instinct as it is with the divine consciousness at its core, has brought some light, light of God. But it is the mind and not the soul that normally guides our life. And this mind has lost that light. All he has learned is soon again in doubt. All the mental knowledge that he acquires, that he accumulates, is put in doubt the next day. New theories come up, new discoveries are made, and all our precious knowledge of today and yesterday loses its value. And we begin to say, all knowledge is relative, no knowledge is absolute. Somewhere else Aurobindo observes how knowledge with its turban of doubt, knowledge is turban with doubt. Where there is human knowledge, mental knowledge, there is always a headgear of doubt. A sun to him seems the shadow of his thoughts. The physical sun, he at times wonders whether it is not an imagination, a construction, a fantasy woven by his thought mind. Then all is shadow again and nothing is true. And he loses his sense of concrete reality. And nothing is true. That's the position of an extreme idealist. They say there is no world at all. You think there is a world. The world is what you feel it is there. It is rendered in your terms. So your mind says that there is a world and you think there is a world. There is actually no such thing as world. These are called idealists in a special sense in the Western philosophy. Then all is shadow again and nothing is true. Unknowing what he does, of the real in ignorance. Now, in all his speculations, weaving of philosophies, discoveries of knowledge, he acts pretty much as he is driven, and he does not really know where it is going to end up, in what direction he is going to proceed. And what he does, all the systems that he constructs are signs of the real in ignorance, real true, the reality, but the reality as quoted by ignorance. There is the cosmic ignorance which is overlaying the reality at the core, and mental knowledge is a fabrication of the sign of this cloaked reality. He has hitched his mortal error to truth star. That is, he goes from error to error, more human error, but the movement of his carriage of error is hitched, tied to the star of truth. That is, one day he will arrive at truth. Error by error he may proceed, but one day the truth star will lead him to the truth. And that's the assurance. Wisdom attracts him with her luminous mask, but never has he seen the face behind. The true face of wisdom he has not seen. But what he mistakes for wisdom is only a mask of wisdom, an appearance of wisdom. A giant ignorance surrounds his lore. All the knowledge that he has built is surrounded by a huge, unbounded ignorance. That is, his highest knowledge is but a product of ignorance, and therefore it is vitiated.
Here.